When Jack Gelber brought us the script of The Connection, we were immediately turned on by it because, as I remembered, it was within 24 hours that we were sure that we were going to do this play. I looked at it, I read it, I gave it to Judith with great excitement. I don't know whether I said to her, this is the next play we're going to do.
I think you did.
Read it and she said yes. And one of the things about it that was among many, many things about it that were attractive to us was the fact that it implied that at last there was a text which would make it possible to at once be real on the stage without feigning realism, without reaching into all of the falsifications of a superficial psychology in order to create a character.
This is Snails and Oysters.
Time to switch into my energetic persona. Hello and welcome to Snails and Oysters, the bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bisexual movie podcast. I'm Nat Roberts.
And I'm Allie Rogers.
And this is our final episode of Pride Month 2022, the worst fucking Pride Month in human history.
Yeah. Woof.
Let's quickly segue away from reality because I can't imagine anyone's coming to us for the hard-hitting facts.
Yeah, let's pivot.
How are you doing, Allie? You had family in town this week, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Went, saw the roses at the Brooklyn Botanical Garden.
Nice.
Watched a lot of Introduced My Mom to Ted Lasso.
that's a very mom show. I feel like my mom probably watches it too.
It is, but I think it's like you forget how raunchy it can be until you're suddenly watching it with your mom.
Ooh, I see what you mean. Great British Bake Off has that same thing. Like big wholesome vibes, and then somebody says something about a soggy bottom.
Well, it's kind of like British humor. It can be very
cheeky, I believe is what they call it.
Yeah. How are you doing?
I'm swell. Yesterday I just hung out with my partner and their kids and had a lovely time. It was the first time I'd seen them since I got back from New York. So I got them some gifts while I was over there. I got the older one is 5. I got him a under the sea puzzle that glows in the dark because he is obsessed with whales at the moment.
Very classic and then, phase. Classic phase.
Yes. Classic oceanographer, astronaut, architect. Right. This is the progression.
Yeah.
And then for the little one's 2. And I got him a toy tool belt. Actually, because there was a time when I went over to help T get a table to like a dining room table and we had to like disassemble it to put it in the back of my Prius. And the little one, we were using tools from a toolbox and the little one picked a wrench up out of the toolbox and loved it so much. Aww. And would not give it back to his mother.
Wow.
And then when we got home and were reassembling the table with the toolbox, he immediately grabbed it again and like burst into tears when we took it away from him and was so upset.
Oh my God.
Like he loved holding that wrench, but of course it's a metal wrench. There was no way we could let him hang on to it. And like he's usually the chill one. Like he is so easygoing. He can like fall off a chair and get up and run off. But for some reason, this wrench really hit him emotionally. He was so attached to
it. Oh, my God.
And so, I got him a little tool belt that includes a soft red plastic wrench that he can hold.
Yeah, child-appropriate wrench.
Exactly, yeah. So he was quite delighted with that.
That's great. That's awesome.
Anyway, I'd say that's a healthy dose of.
Sorry. What was that?
I'm a pack rat and I hang on to things like glass jars a lot. And so there's just a pile of glass jars at my feet every time we record. And I kicked one and don't worry, it didn't break. But Yeah, I don't know why I do it anymore. I just save like spice jars and glass peanut butter jars. And I'm like, I'll do something with them. I'll do something with
them. We'll see. We'll see what project comes out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I figure if I ever start making like kombucha or
sun tea.
Sun tea.
Yeah. Then you're going to want all the jars.
Yeah. Miso, like whatever. Mm-hmm. I'll set up a fermentation area.
Station? A fermentation station. Yeah.
I was trying to avoid that.
Nope.
Walked right into it. Well, yeah. Let's walk right into this week's episode. Yes. The 1983 documentary Signals Through the Flames.
Let's do it. Signals Through the Flames is a 1983 documentary on the work of Julian Beck and Judith Malina, who are the founders of The Living Theater.
The Living Theater is an experimental theater group that is sort of heavily influenced by the work of Antonin Artaud, who was a pioneer of the theater of cruelty, which is sort of similar to like what you might think of like a shock jock on the radio, where the idea is to shock the audience. But in theater of cruelty, the intention is to shock the audience out of complacency and into sort of a revolutionary mindset. So the Living Theater takes a lot of its tradition from that same mission to sort of shake people up and get them to question society.
And it made me question a lot of society.
Yeah, because the documentary mostly just covers the history, the early history of the Living Theater, when it really is like Beck and Malina like variously running out of money to put on shows, getting arrested, fleeing the United States for Rome, for Paris, for London, coming back to the States, and just continuing to try to do like really avant-garde theatrical work.
Yeah, and it cuts back and forth between performances of their plays and then like interviews with them. And there's a lot of protest footage as well. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, I think those are like the three basic building blocks that make up the film.
Along with like diary entries and interviews with Malina and Beck. Mm. Some important backstory is that while this documentary doesn't cover much of Malina and Beck's backstory, the two of them were married but had an open marriage and actually shared several lovers between them, including, you know, male actors in their company or my favorite was a man named Lester Schwartz, who was a bisexual shipyard worker.
I saw that in the Wikipedia page and I was like, wow.
So while it isn't an explicit part of this documentary, Julian Beck himself was bisexual. And so he's sort of the reason we're here today. And so today's episode is going to be a little bit different because we won't be discussing so much how Beck's bisexuality is portrayed so much as how his queerness relates to the work of the Living Theater. And with that, let's get into it.
Here we go.
So, Ali, what's your relationship with like experimental theater or avant-garde theater? Like, have you ever gone to see anything like this in person, or do you have an interest in it? Like,
avoided at all costs.
You avoid it at all costs.
Yeah, I mean, it's not for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough. I can't say that I've ever. I mean, once in college, I went to a performance that felt experimental-ish because it was like different scenes happening throughout the theater and outside of the theater. Mm-hmm. And everyone started in a different spot, but then all ended in the auditorium, and that felt weird.
Yeah.
I think that there's like sometimes a polarity thing that happens with people who are interested in comedy and people who are interested in like experimental theater. And I think sometimes those overlap really well. And sometimes there's just like an oil and water thing going on.
I think you're right. Cause I feel actually, I have a similar thing where it's like, I've never sought out this sort of theater, to be honest. I've seen bits and pieces in like college shows and like, you know, like back at NYU, there was the experimental theater group in the acting school. And I knew a lot of people who did that sort of theater. And they always had these really interesting ideas, but Yeah, I don't enjoy it is the thing. And it's not that it's there to end, like all art is not there to entertain, but there is just a difference between enjoying and being entertained. And I think enjoyment is somewhat necessary. Like even with like something really dark, like a movie like Parasite or something, I still enjoy the experience, even if it doesn't make me happy, you know?
Yeah. And it's hard. A lot of what I found myself feeling throughout this film was like that there are just certain ways of being an artist and talking about art that feel outdated to me. And I just felt a lot of that through that film. And part of that felt like a loss. Mm-hmm. I mean, both the founders of the theater, Julian Beck and Judith Malina, the way that they talked about like politics and revolution and their art and like what the theater should do was so committed and earnest.
Yeah.
And passionate, even the way that Julian talks about vegetarianism.
Yeah. I found that scene really interesting.
It was really interesting. Yeah. But it also felt like such a artistic and intense, like it felt like the most extreme way to talk to like let someone know you're a vegetarian. Yeah. Basically in this scene, because I think it's like not super likely that a lot of our listeners have.
I would be shocked if anyone listening had heard of this movie before this episode came out.
Oh, yeah. I'll just explain the scene. He's talking about violence in our culture, and he's talking about how like the violence of the state through like the death penalty and the way that like police are authorized and enabled to use violence then like creates violence within society, and how, and then he like relates that to how like we are violent every day by consuming meat. And it's just really interesting because I feel like, and maybe it's just the circles that I'm in, but I feel like in this kind of like post-irony world, it's really, really hard to find those types of like passionate, committed. There's a real like irony poisoned affect to almost all art. Almost all art today, I feel, is winking a little bit. And there's no winking in this.
None at all. It's interesting that you picked this vegetarian scene to make that point, because I think you're absolutely right. Like, it shows how, like, Beck and Malina live their entire lives through a unified practice, whether they're making art, making dinner, making love. Like, they are trying to apply consistent principles across the board, which is both admirable, but also, like, almost ludicrous a little bit to watch, where not to say that in an insulting way, but just that it's so deeply committed, you know. It's so rare to meet someone today who has like a cause like they do.
Oh yeah, because I think there's been a really important point made in like recent years about the limits of individual action.
Right.
To like affect change. And that's been really important because it's basically trying to put the onus back on, you know, for example, oil companies for climate change and government for like our lack of a welfare system and social safety net, and like trying to really like and putting the onus on like billionaires for inequality. But I think a side effect of that like really important redirection is also like, I think a lot of the individual action that they take in this film or that might have like given someone like real meaning. Yeah. I feel like everyone I know who might take a political stance, like I feel like the vegetarians I know, me included, were like apologetic vegetarians.
Absolutely. No, I know exactly what you mean. Like when I was watching that scene, I was thinking like, I've been a vegetarian for 16 years. And when people talk like this, I check out of the conversation.
Yeah.
But the thing is like the nice thing is this time I really tried to like listen more carefully and think about it more deeply. As a vegetarian, I think I'm slightly unusual in that I don't think it's actually inherently unethical to kill an animal to eat it. I think it's more unethical to like clear grasslands to make way for factory farms. But I do think that the way our current food production system does it is out of balance. You know, to me, it's not that life is the enemy of death. It's that life and death are in a constant dance.
And that's why you'll never found your own experimental theater company. You don't
I'm
have
not
to
committed
commitment.
Enough to my vegetarianism. You're right.
Yeah. But anyways, I forget your initial question.
Oh, I don't think it matters. But we started out talking about like experimental theater. I'd love to talk about it a little more, though, because I have a weird tension in my opinions about avant-garde art, where I think that it's unfairly maligned in a lot of popular culture. I think a lot of people shit on it unfairly. Like abstract modernism is a great example. Works of people like Lee Krasner and Grace de Kooning, and probably most famously Jackson Pollock. You know, this idea that a lot of more conservative or reactionary commenters made at the time was like, oh, my six-year-old could do that. Those have sort of permeated popular culture. You know, like I think it's pretty standard for a sitcom or a, you know, comedy film to take a pot shot at contemporary avant-garde art.
Definitely.
Which I think is really unfair, because I think that the people practicing this form, when they take it seriously, can generate some really interesting ideas that actually are worth discussing and you know, sort of facing. At the same time, I think that the people who practice avant-garde art tend to make these big assertions that what they're doing is actively creating like a force field that's going to ripple out and change the world. And I think that that's equally out of touch with reality. I feel like what I want is for somebody to just say, like, we are doing this work in the hopes that it will raise consciousness, but we have no idea if it will actually work. You know, I think there's just a lack of humility on both sides of this debate, you know?
Yeah, I know. But it's hard because I can't help but wonder if you need that lack of humility to do this kind of performance. I'm like, is it just...
Yeah, I thought about that, yeah.
Yeah, but it's like, I don't know, because I agree with you. It there's elements of it that really irk me as well, of that kind of, oh, we're gonna change everything. But I'm also like, how else do you justify getting arrested?
I know.
You know, because you have to have like a mission. But I get what you mean. It's like, could there be perhaps a balance? They would say...
No.
No, fuck
yeah.
You.
But I also think it's interesting to like delve into that term avant-garde. It literally means front guard or vanguard in an artistic context. But I think this documentary shows how that is explicitly tied to being a vanguard in a political context of like raising political consciousness, of forming. I think Beck at one point talks about forming this tribe, you know, that the Living Theater formed a tribe of sort of vanguard artists and political thinkers who are out to radicalize the masses. You know, there's a lot of conversation about the masses versus the vanguard.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me personally in politics, I'm actually very anti-vanguard. I think that a vanguard paradigm is antithetical to revolution.
Can you explain, like, what that... Because I was honestly a little like, what exactly do they
exactly
mean?
Yeah. Well, I think that that's an important question, because I think the vanguard conceives of itself in political terms. Through my organizing in various leftist groups, which is still relatively young. Like, I don't mean to sound like I'm trying to make myself out as the old veteran of the left. But in my experience, vanguardists tend to think that in order to have some sort of social revolution, you need a cadre, like a limited group of revolutionaries who then go out and proselytize to the masses or radicalize the masses or act first or lead the masses towards revolution. In my experience, the modern vanguardists tend to see themselves as the middle managers of the revolution. Mm. You know, they think that they're going to be the bosses once we overthrow the bosses. But of course, they're good guys, so they'll get out of the way once the people no longer need bosses. But at first, they're gonna need bosses to tell them how, you know, what to do. Otherwise, they'll be lost little lambs. Personally, I think that's bullshit. Mm. I think that, you know, the average person is well aware of what's wrong with society and what we could do to fix it. It's just that we feel disempowered and alienated. And so we think, and alienated by vanguardist movements who talk down to the average person. And so they instead of enervating the majority of people to rise up in revolution, they disenchant them instead. And so I think it's much more the job of any sort of like existing revolutionary to say, like, hey, you are my equal. You know, I may have like said this first, but you knew it too. Like, to talk that way rather than to say like, let me help you, you wandering, you know, proletariat dunce.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's an anarchist take on vanguards.
Yeah, it's hard because this whole film is steeped in such a specific political context.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of terms that they use, like vanguard or even revolution, where like I always want to pause, reach through the film and be like, what do you mean?
Well, yeah.
Define revolution.
Especially given that Beck is an anarcho-pacifist, which is wonderful. I have a great deal of respect for anarcho-pacifists. Like Ursula Le Guin was an anarcho-pacifist. But in Beck's case, at least, there is this sort of question of like, well, what is the revolution? Like, we're not shooting people. That's great. But what is it?
Yeah, exactly. Because it's just even like what it looks like. I remember at one point early on, Judith Malina is on a train, I believe. Mm-hmm. And she's talking about, oh, you know, we thought at this one moment that like we were going to change. Yeah, we were going to change the way we like related to each other and the way we ate. And I just wanted to pause and say, like, what did you want it to look
right.
like? You know, yeah. But that's just like, I don't know. It goes to my own personal like difficulties I have sometimes in political spaces where I feel like this tension between like this beautiful thing that someone wants, but they can't describe it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I actually think they probably could have described it. I think they were very committed. Clearly, I think their ideas were really well thought out. I'm not sure it was included in the film.
Yeah. And I think that that's a common like way of describing like that. The period of like May 1968 was sort of this, people thought it was going to be like the beginning of a revolution. And instead it was kind of the end of a revolutionary period where we enter this nadir of the 70s and 80s when like the Reagan and Thatcher revolution comes along and like, again, as I've said a million times before, just says like stupidity is good. Capitalism is the only system. Like everybody shut up. Mm-hmm. And that really lasted until I would say like 2016 or so.
2016.
I would say that there's been like a lack of political consciousness in like contemporary art discourse since then. Like I feel like it's just been so repressed. That we keep talking about art for art's sake, or, you know, saying like, oh, don't make it political as if that's a bad thing. Whereas like, you know, before it was much more acceptable to be like, you know, I'm making, you know, I'm an anarchist and this is an anarchist film, or I am a communist. And this is, you know, I feel like there has been a resurgence of radical language in at least the, you know, American context. I don't know. I can't speak to whether or not the French or other parts of the world were still talking that way. I just know that from my perception of the U.S., there was a definite nadir.
Totally. When did you first see this film?
Today.
How did you come across it?
Well, I was doing research on I was reading up on experimental theater, and I came across not only the fact that Julian Beck was bisexual, but that there was a documentary about the Living Theater. And I had been wanting to do more documentaries on the show about like real life bisexuals. And this felt like a really good opportunity. So sight unseen, I was like, let's do it. But yeah, I had been reading up because I was part of like an anti-capitalism for artists reading group. It's actually called Anti-Capitalism for Artists. It's a great organization run by Chris Myers. But as part of the group I was in, we read some essays about Theater of the Oppressed, which is a different experimental theatrical form developed by Augusto Boal that is based on Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. It's sort of the idea there is that you get the audience to participate in the theater that's being made as a way of like giving them a sense of their own agency and power. Mm-hmm. So it's deeply interrelated with the work that the Living Theater is doing, but it takes a very different tact. Mm. That sort of led me into this because the other side of my relationship with the avant-garde is that I do think that it's great that it exists because some of those ideas can filter into more mainstream applications. Like I often think about it like theoretical physics and engineering, where it's like, you know, we may make a physicist may make a discovery that seems to have no practical outcome. And then, you know, 50 years later, an engineer is looking over their work and applies it and, you know, completely revolutionizes the way we live our lives. You know,
totally.
Electricity is a great example of that.
Love electricity.
Yeah, we love it. Yeah, I hate to talk about art in such mechanical terms, but I do think that like the experimental avant-garde is in some ways necessary as a counterbalance to the pull of like practical capitalism or serving the state or, you know, the patronage system of art.
Yeah.
You need to have artists who are like, no, fuck everybody. Even if I don't, I clearly personally have not chosen to be one of them.
Yeah. It's funny that you describe that as like a mechanical way of viewing it, because I, having, you know, I'm just maturing so much every day, every hour. I mature, I become wiser. And mm-hmm. something that has really been happening in my brain lately is like when I encounter something that maybe isn't for me.
Yeah.
I'm just like trying to think more in general of every aspect of life as like an ecosystem, you know?
Yeah.
And like, once you, like, I really recommend everyone do this and just be like me and be as mature and as
yeah,
wise
as wonderful,
me.
As but, developed.
As developed, as just
as
like,
evolved, as self-actualized.
Yeah, exactly. But like, I do feel like what you're describing isn't mechanical. To me, you're just describing like an ecosystem of art. And like,
yeah.
within that ecosystem, you do need like this committed group of people who are like really political and really experimental and really like shoving art in your face to balance out the like hundreds of Marvel movies.
Yeah.
You know? So like it makes sense like to me what you're saying. It doesn't sound mechanical at all. It just sounds like, yeah, that's how like we operate.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And it's not about having an avant-garde to lead us so much as it is like it's like you said, it's more like the water cycle, like you said, or like the nitrogen cycle in the environment where you need every part of it in order to really have a healthy system. Because if it was all avant-garde all the time, everyone would be fucking miserable.
We would die.
Honestly. No, seriously. I think like I often think about the Preston Sturges film Sullivan's Travels. Have we talked about this movie before?
I don't know.
Oh, it's a classic. It's one
Is
of the DVDs
the one where
I
someone
own.
Gets like tied up by little tiny men. That's
Gulliver's Travels, but the title is a reference to that, so not too far off. But Sullivan's Travels is this movie shot and set during the Great Depression about, I'll give you the relevant bit, which is that the main character is this film director named Sullivan who does comedies but really wants to direct an adaptation of this great novel called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is where the Coen brothers got that title. But he wants to be taken seriously, basically. So he goes on the road pretending to be just sort of a vagrant to see what life is really like so that he can do research for this film. And through various, through the whole thing, it's this screwball comedy about a guy who doesn't really know what it's like to be poor, until the main character ends up in prison and all his friends think he's dead through a misunderstanding. And so he's trapped in prison, and it goes from like a lighthearted comedy to a really dark drama where in prison he's beaten. He is put in a hot box on like a 100-degree day.
Jesus.
He is just abused constantly. And it's a really dark sequence. And in the middle of it, the prisoners are taken to a black church where they are shown like old like Mickey Mouse cartoons. Like there's a movie and they're taken to see the movie and he starts laughing in the theater and he like turns to the guy next to him and he says, am I laughing? And so anyway, through various other like, you know, screwball means, he escapes, he's freed from prison, returns to life in Hollywood, and he walks into the executive's office and they're like, okay, you're finally ready to make Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And he says, actually, I'd rather make a comedy. But I think that speaks to a real tension in the life of somebody who makes art as their main thing. Like it's something I feel, I bet it's something you feel as well, where it's, you're trying to balance like, yes, I want to make works of art that are about real life, you know, real problems in the world. But I also like the people who have real problems don't need me to tell them about it, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's a balancing act where it's like you're trying to speak to what's real without just observing it or without trying to romanticize it or turn it into poverty porn.
Yeah.
And you want to like raise people's consciousness, but you also want to make their lives easier. Cause I can say like one of the biggest problems I've seen in leftist spaces is burnout, where like people just don't rest, just don't take care of themselves. And so, you know, if every play you're going to is like seven naked men on stage screaming at each other.
Yeah, I will
say. That's not very relaxing.
I will say this film had a little too much screaming.
Yeah. And like the thing is like.
Every scene where they were on stage, they were just yelling. And I was like, wow.
Yeah. And at a certain point, it's like, I think that's partly a product of like times changing, where screaming, like I'm sure the first time somebody did it, it was very interesting, but now totally. It's become sort of played out.
It's like now how like so many TV shows are trying to mimic the secession style.
Exactly.
Like dialogue.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you fucking blah, blah, blah.
You fucking fuck. Yeah.
Elaborate little metaphor, but with curses.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. And it is sort of like why art so rarely lasts beyond its period is because tastes shift, you know, as a direct result of something popular. Tastes initially go towards and then away from it.
Yeah. It's a love-hate cycle.
Yeah. Let's talk more though about Beck and Melina as people, because they're very interesting. Like if we treat them as fictional characters, they're very like weird, interesting people.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, Beck himself sort of looks like he looks like Riff Raff literally, from Rocky Horror Picture Show, to be honest.
Literally chose the most hilarious signature haircut, which is just to accept a certain amount of male pattern baldness. Actually, quite a bit of
a great degree of male pattern baldness. Agree.
And then to have this overgrown halo, like quite long halo of hair.
Like pure white, like corkscrew curls.
Yeah, it's a choice. It's a choice.
And it's interesting because he, like you said earlier, he doesn't wink at all. Like there's no self-awareness or self-mockery for his beliefs. Like he's one of those people who just, he believes what he believes and he says it without like the slightest trace of irony.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very strange. Like he's a very gothic looking man with a very like sort of high reedy voice, but he has like a real draw to him too, where it's like you get why he's in the theater, because you do want to just keep looking at him.
Yeah, no, definitely. He's like really distinctive, and just the way he talks is really, you know, oratory. Is that a word? But not in a bad way.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but you feel very much like he's someone who's really thinking about what he's saying and really into the performance of what he's saying. He's like a storyteller. Exactly. You know, he's a hashtag storyteller like everyone in LA.
It's interesting to see him and Melina together, because like they just clearly have so much respect for each other. Like that feels like the defining quality of their relationship, is like there's this great like introductory vignette where they're talking about how they met. And it's like Melina was like outside of like some New York nightclub, and she ran into a playwright she knew who was like starving. And so she took him to the automat, and he said, "I know someone who's going to change your life forever. Wait here." And he goes and gets Julian Beck and like brings him to the automat to introduce them. And then they like just get married and create a theater company and are together for the rest of their lives.
Also, really quick, an automat is just a vending machine, right? Or is this a relic?
It's like
past?
A restaurant vending machine. It's got like a it. Whole restaurant where you just put in a coin and get a ham sandwich out of a
so
little
weird.
Door. Yeah, they used to be all over in New York.
Yeah, I mean, their introduction and that story that they met just feels like such a, you know, New York before Giuliani way of, you know, falling in love, where artists were just banging into each other all the time, falling in love and starting these brilliant projects. And someone was always saying something like, you know, someone was always
something
like, oh,
very deep. Yeah.
I've just never in my life said to anyone, I need to introduce you to someone who's going to change your life. Like, we just live in such a different world of feelings and emotions. Like, I think the most I've ever said to someone is like, oh, my friend lives in the city you're moving to.
You should meet.
Yeah, here's number, but if yeah. you don't meet up, all good. You know,
like, all good. Yeah.
I'm just like, I'm a little jealous for sure of just the romanticism of this whole period, you know?
Oh, yeah. Like, I can definitely relate to that. In the past year or two, I've read two books about this period of New York, which is Just Kids by Patti Smith, which is sort of her memoir of her and Robert Mapplethorpe living in New York in the 60s. And then Ninth Street Women, which is about the women of the abstract modernist movement, which is interesting that actually I think Beck mentions the abstract modernist movement in this movie because he himself briefly dabbled in painting as an abstract modernist. But it is interesting to see the symmetry of like how the same concerns led to the living theater as led to abstract modernism in painting, where it's like, you know, sort of breaking down traditional forms that had become accepted by the bourgeois establishment. This vibe of like just sitting around coffee shops until 3 a.m. drinking coffee because you spent your last nickel on it and you get unlimited refills or something like that. Just like, you know, this sort of like very raw, very almost dangerous sort of commitment to art, where it's like you are risking arrest and poverty and starvation to just do this all the time. And it just doesn't seem viable anymore.
Yeah. And you're putting like a lot of your personal relationships on the line. Just the fact that their relationship with each other was also bound up in this theater that they founded. Yeah. And like you said, at the top of the show, like they had this kind of comprehensive, you know, political commitment of this way they wanted to live that just went through everything they did. And it's just really funny. It makes me feel a bit like I don't often think of our current moment as conservative,
yeah.
but I've been thinking a lot about that word in general since we recorded 500 Days of Summer.
Yeah.
And you brought that up as a critique. And I was just thinking about the way that we kind of gossip about celebrity dating lives and sex lives. And I was just like thinking about this couple who founded a theater where the theater is always doing naked performances and they're kind of have this open relationship. And I was just like, God, I feel like some of the things that they did were just would shock the audiences of 2022. You know, like, I don't know. I think about the obsession that went over a photograph of Taika Waititi, like kissing
right,
one
with
woman.
Rita Ora and Tessa Thompson.
Right. He was kissing one woman with an arm around another woman. And I'm like, it's so funny because it's like we really in a way of or I just think about the way that like I don't know. Can you think of any couple artists right now? I'm sure they're out there. I don't want to say they're not out there.
Oh, sure. But in the public eye.
In the public eye. It's possible that I'm just not paying enough attention to abstract or experimental art. That's been true for 99% of my life. But I'm just saying that, like, where are the radicals? Like, where are the people, you know, who are like, we're in an open relationship and we're committed to this ideology? I mean, I think of, I guess, Rooney Mara.
Mm-hmm.
Rooney Mara and Joaquin Phoenix, I think they go to like a vigil every weekend at a slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
For pigs. That's like the most radical thing I can think of.
Yeah. That's the thing. I can think of like Susan Sarandon and Danny DeVito honestly came to mind as like the most publicly radical and like furthest left, like A-list celebrities these days.
Mm-hmm.
But it does feel like there was a time where like, you know, Harry Belafonte or Paul Robeson could be like A-list stars while saying like, I am a communist or I am like, you know, supporting Bobby Kennedy. Like, whereas now like the, you know, those two, like Susan Sarandon, it's become like a punchline that Susan Sarandon gets blamed anytime a centrist does something stupid.
Right. And even like, I think that is even more high stakes.
Yeah.
Like the actually making like a political commitment. Like I remember Vampire Weekend got shit for playing a Bernie rally early on.
Totally.
But I'm even saying in the lower stakes world of personal of radicalism
personal.
And relational radicalism, I'm just kind of like, when I think about the couples out there who, I mean, I guess Esther Perel has had a big influence on our culture, but like, I don't know. I think about celebrities who are famous for their relationships, and it's mostly celebrities who are like monogamous and married and just talk about being unhappy all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Or talk about how hard it is to be married, and they're like so famous for that. And I'm like, God, like, it's kind of funny, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I can totally understand why if a celebrity was in a sort of you know, more radical arrangement, they would keep it to themselves, because look at the salacious gossip around somebody like Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith, where it's like even the implication that they have an open relationship has led to all of this rumor mongering about who and when and what and where.
Yeah, I think a lot of that has been really cruel.
Yeah, I think it leads to neuroticism. I think part of the reason that we think of celebrities as neurotic is because our society treats them like they are.
Yeah, or makes them neurotic eventually, exactly. One way or another.
Yeah.
But do you know more about their... So they were not both bisexual. It was just Julian?
As far as I know, it was just him, but I could be mistaken.
And do you know more about their relationship?
Not much more.
Wow, how dare you?
Yeah, sorry. I should have been more of an expert.
Well, what did you see in the film? Like, because I'll be honest.
Go for it.
I watched the film and I was honestly shocked by the lack of discussion of their queerness, given how radical other elements of the film were. You know, like talking openly about revolution. We need to change the way we eat and relate to each other. What's up with that?
I'm glad you pointed that out, because I was curious going into this movie how much or how little they would talk about queerness, and they talked about it not at all.
Not at all.
Explicitly. Like, Beck has a very camp persona, I would say. Not very like camp like John Waters, but like sort of, you know, effete slightly. And I don't mean that as a denigration. And you can see, like, sort of as he's walking around, like, touching people, talking to them. Like, he has a very loose and open persona with his physicality. But, yeah, it's never discussed, like, you know, that he is bi, despite the fact that, like you said, this whole movie is about radicalism. It leads to a sort of interesting question of documentary ethics, I think, where... Yes,
don't get me started. Don't get me started on documentary ethics.
I would actually be very curious to hear what you think of that, because my brain sort of went through this two-step thing where it's like, well, that makes sense. The political revolution is more relevant to their work because their work is explicitly revolutionary, but their work is also incredibly queer. Like, it's about nudity and desire and primal screams and the unacceptable urges we all have. Like, that's incredibly queer. And, you know, as much as Beck's politics figure into his particular participation in art, his sexuality must have as well. Like, I think everyone's sexuality does, even if, you know, when you're straight, it's considered normal or part of the background radiation. But, you know, everyone's sexual experience is relevant to their experience of life, you know, their sexual orientation at least. And so for the documentary to completely exclude open discussion of sexuality beyond a general philosophical pondering, it's questionable. What did you think?
Yeah, I was also just a bit puzzled by it.
It feels like an omission. Rather than just, yeah.
Yeah, it does feel like an omission. I mean, I can't quite remember, but I don't think they even talk about their open relationship, do they?
Nope. I don't believe they do.
It's hard not to feel like it was purposeful. Just because Julian is a man who's able to, within minutes, get from the death penalty to... This is why we all need to be vegetarian.
Yeah.
And maybe, he says, maybe even not eat plants, but let's start with animals.
Vegetarians, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's hard for me to imagine that he was extremely, like, not talkative about his queerness. But it's also, like, I don't know. It's possible. It's extremely possible that they just kept that very private. To me, though, because so much of the film is so political and actually includes so much protest footage.
Yeah.
Like, I learned about something I'd never known about before, which is, like, the French uprising of 1984.
1968?
Right, 1968. Was it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a classic, yeah. That's the thing. It is interesting how, like, once you, like, I feel like one of the first things I learned when entering leftist circles was about May 68 as, like, this, like, big deal year. And it was, like, it was a huge general strike in France. Like, don't mean to underplay it, and student protests, but it was also, again, like I said, sort of fizzled out period of revolution. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, so I guess it's a little hard for me to imagine that conversations about, you know, his queerness, his open relationship didn't naturally arise. So I guess I would love to learn more, and honestly, I might do some research later, and maybe we'll like throw in a post-recording thing, but I'd love to learn to understand more. But my guess would be that there's always the fear of salaciousness.
Yeah.
I think like people who are in open relationships, no matter their sexual orientation, really fear that.
Yeah.
That like they're, you know, like that their relationship is going to be like scrutinized and talked about as like this gossipy thing. And I think bisexual people always fear being kind of hypersexualized. And then totally. Like if you're participating in both, you might just have like a lot of anxiety. You might keep that really private. Or if you're a filmmaker trying to make a political film, you might be like, let's not put anything distracting.
Yeah. I personally wonder if it was the second one. Because speaking as a bi man who is in a poly relationship, I partly because I have a chip on my shoulder tend to be more open about it than I necessarily would be, just to like represent myself a little bit. But that's also a product of the times. You know, I'm living in 2022. This film was shot in 1983, which was definitely a peak of homophobia in the global north. And so, yeah, I think that's entirely possible. But I do think that there is a tendency in political circles to see things like race and queerness and gender as extraneous.
Yeah.
And that revolution and class are really what matters. It's a position often called class reductionism. Mm-hmm. I think it's borderline fascist, but not that I'm saying the filmmaker was a class reductionist. But there is that impulse to focus solely on revolutionary politics and to categorize identity politics as something else, which frankly, I think that that distinction is completely ludicrous because class is also an identity anyway. But I can't help but wonder if it was like that impulse to say that the queerness would distract rather than that the queerness was integral to the politics.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And because, I mean, this is a theater group that is already like, you know, getting arrested, traveling around to different parts of the world, like performing naked. I don't know how shocking that necessarily was, but, you know, getting written up in the Times for being arrested while doing a play. So they get arrested while they're doing a play about the horrors of prison. And so they have to be like taken out of the
fake prison.
that is on stage. I mean, that I really laughed. I thought that was hilarious. But like, I think I agree that especially like there's a lot going on for them.
Yeah.
You know, like I feel like you could see another headline that's like theater group that is constantly arrested is also all fucking each other. But
yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think it's normal for theater groups to fuck each other, but
to be a polycule.
Yeah.
You know, I do remember
as someone who has avoided theater. Like I'm like, I don't want any part of that, you weirdos.
But I did remember there is one part where his queerness sort of comes to the fore, where he's reading I think it's his journal entry about when they're doing a production of The Maids, where they're sort of doing it as men in drag. He talks about being sort of excited and aroused by this gender play where he's, you know, putting on tights and a dress.
Yeah.
The play itself, I don't know if you're familiar, is very much concerned with like sadomasochism and class again and gender. There's actually a really great film version of The Maids that stars our beloved Glenda Jackson.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, Glenda.
It's on Criterion Channel. But yeah, the play itself is a French play by Jean Genet that's gone through various iterations. But it is interesting that they included mention of Beck cross-dressing on stage without diving into like how does this relate to your gender expression, your queerness. Like obviously some of those terms are very modern, but you know, there were definitely conversations around bisexuality, you know, certainly as early as 1983 and as early as, you know, 63, which is I think the earliest year mentioned in this film. It's curious how they don't fully expunge it, but they don't talk about it.
Yeah, no, it's just like a passing moment.
Now, you know more about documentary than I do. Do you feel like that is ethical to just sort of exclude something like that?
I mean, I don't really think documentary is ethical to begin with.
Really?
I mean, I just think there's a lot of issues with it that I think, you know, you can't include everything about someone's life without just creating a simulacrum of their life and then a live streaming essentially their life. And I think
sort of synecdoche New Yorking it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say. I almost feel like a word like ethical is just too, I think every documentary excludes things and includes other things, or like privileges some things by, you know, it's just like, I think there's issues with it.
Yeah.
Like, I guess I would say in this specific film, I would say it feels like a bit of a loss because this film captures so well an important theater and also an important style of theater and the two founders in the middle of it all. And so I would say that, like, as an artifact of this time and this culture, it hurts me to be like, we could have had more understanding. So, like, from that point of view, I feel, like, sad. But to me, it's hard to assign an ethical judgment without understanding the motivations of the filmmaker, without understanding, because, like, the reality is, ethical to who? You know, there's lots of times that a filmmaker is being ethical to the audience or to the film and being unethical to the subject. You see that? I mean, I don't know if you saw the documentary Wiener with Anthony Wiener.
But I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah. You could argue that in this film, like, they, in exposing the fact that he was caught in yet another sexting scandal, that was, they were being extremely ethical to the voters of New York and the audience and extremely unethical to their subject.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's impossible to know without knowing how they felt about it.
Right.
You know, maybe they asked, maybe they withheld, maybe they tried not to talk about it. Maybe they specifically said, don't include it. Then that's ethical. If, if however, there's reams of footage that was somehow left on the cutting board, that feels like, I think a disappointing choice, you know?
Yeah. I agree. I think you're right that it can't be as simple as yes, no, ethical, unethical. That was a really interesting. Yeah, I think I was thinking about it in much simpler terms, and you definitely disabused me of that. So thank you.
Well, it took years of thinking about watching. Well, it's just funny because I do think a lot of people perceive. I think a lot of people are exposed to the documentary films that kind of have missions.
Right. Like, I think Michael Moore is probably the most contemporary example of that.
Yeah, Michael Moore. But even, like, more recently, or, like, people might, like Blackfish. Remember Blackfish on Netflix was huge. And, like, that was the mission of the film. So I think, like, people associate documentary filmmaking with an ethical mission to reveal some truth or push some agenda or right some wrong.
Right. Like an expose.
Yeah, like an expose. And like sometimes the best expose films have like the gnarliest practices that got them there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even like Michael Moore, I remember in my film class in college, studied him and talked, and like, there's like a famous scene in one of his films where someone is skinning a bunny or something, like growing, like raising bunnies for food.
Yeah.
And it turned out that like he really played up that person. Like there's just like, I don't know. It's such a, I think like the general idea that documentary film is ethical, we should all be disabused of that notion. You know, there's like almost always when you're putting a camera between one human and another,
something bad might happen.
I mean, because ultimately, like you're creating a character of a person, and that's almost always going to lead to some pain.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, because it forces a tough dilemma where it's like, if the documentary is inherently somewhat unethical, not making documentaries would also be kind of unethical because then we would be letting the truth, like, you know, dwell in darkness.
Yeah, I'm definitely a fan of, we should all keep making documentaries. I'm just like I think one of my personal crusades is to get people to stop thinking of them as like, always missions that were always made with good.
Totally.
If maybe they were made with good intentions, but poor practice. And I also want to shake a lot of documentary filmmakers and be like, you are not a hero.
Yeah.
Like, you are not a hero. And also, like, you're, I think, like, similar, honestly, to bring it to the end this rant on documentary and bring it back to the film. I think within documentary film, a lot of times there are filmmakers who truly, truly believe that their film is going to change the world. And that's why they're making the film. And I think there would be better films and potentially, you know, more ethical, or like films that have a better relationship between the subject and the end product, if we stopped fooling ourselves that a film can change the world.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that once you start giving into those apocalyptic images of, you know, I am a god king, I can change the world with my arts, you start acting less human. You know,
because
in doing so, you reduce the value of human life.
You do, because the second you decide that the story you're telling is more important than the literal human lives that you're using to tell the story, like, even if you're changing small things, I don't know. It's a tricky, tricky area, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. And I think what it comes down to is, you can be sure of the harm you're doing to a person. You can't be sure of the impact of a work of art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But it's funny because, like, mm-hmm. I think a lot of their art, I think, like, even though they had a similar commitment to, like, wanting to change the world, I don't find it as, like, cringy as a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah.
Because all of the performers themselves are so committed. You know, I don't have that kind of tricky issue of portrayal. Portrayal, like an issue of portrayal, because they're all in it portraying themselves.
Yeah.
I don't know. I find it, like, more
palatable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny that, yeah, we talk about that sort of God King mentality. I think it actually reminds me of My Dinner with Andre. Have you ever seen that one?
No.
So it's a movie about two, like, middle-aged white guys having dinner and talking about art. And that's the entire movie. And by no race, way. That should be so boring. But it's so good. Andre really? Gregory and Wallace Shawn play the two characters. And it's so interesting because they sort of go through this cycle that we went through, which is, like, talking about the importance of the avant-garde, but then critiquing it and saying, like, you know, these big emotional, you know, short circuits that we use in theater are also, like, what fascists use to short circuit people's brains. And also, like, does any of it mean anything? Or, like, is it ethical to do these things? And, like, Wallace Shawn has a beautiful monologue in it about, you know, every morning I wake up and my girlfriend pours me a cup of cold coffee. And I just think that it's, you know, it's so wrong to expect more than that out of life.
Mm.
Something like that. And it's just a really interesting meditation on why do we do this? Why do we make art? Honestly.
I love that. I'll definitely have to watch that. Can we do it? Is it any part of it by?
No, unfortunately not.
Tragic.
But, I highly encourage, I don't want it to sound like I feel like I've been a little critical of this documentary in this episode, but I would highly encourage everyone to go watch it, because even if abstract, avant-garde, expressionist theater isn't your cup of tea, maybe part of it could be. I don't know. Like, maybe at the very least, be sure that it isn't, you know, look at it. Like, I think part of the limitation is that we're watching recordings of this rather than going to see it live. But
I do think, in that way, it reminded me of concert documentaries, like music documentaries, which are notoriously hard to pull off.
Apart from Stop Making Sense, which is a perfect movie. And will show up on a Patreon bonus at some point.
I would really say, like, to all of our hundreds and thousands of listeners,
totally.
This film, I think, even if you're not into avant-garde art or radical politics, it's an amazing time capsule of a particular, like, moment in art and in history that's kind of compelling to watch. And I'd also say that, like, this is the kind of film that I wouldn't be surprised if it's, like, being screened at micro cinemas or, you know, documentary.
Funny you should mention that. Yeah.
Is it being screened at a micro cinema?
Yeah. Well, it has because I believe it's in the public domain because the rights were acquired by the Yale School of Drama.
Nice.
And so it's been screened for free to the public multiple times over the years since it was made. So We'll post the link to the Internet Archive copy of it that you can watch at home. But, you know, check out. Maybe there's a theater playing it near you. You may be surprised to find out.
Yeah. And I say that, too, because I think because the Living Theater still exists.
Yep.
And yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it gets screened with like a really interesting Q&A or, you know, something that would also like, I think understanding like the context of this film really helps to like bring it all to life in a beautiful way.
Yeah. Well, speaking of documentary ethics, as we discussed in our By the Way episode, I don't think it's ethical for us to play Mary Fuck Kill with real people. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that's going to be a pass.
Yeah. So instead, we'll just close this week's episode and say thank you so much for listening to Snails and Oysters, the bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bi-sexual movie podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, review it, rate it, thumbs up, whatever your chosen platform lets you do. We appreciate anything you give us. It really does help the show. Mm-hmm. And if you really, really want to help us out, you can head to patreon.com/snailsoysters to become a supporter of the podcast. It's $5 a month. You get monthly bonus episodes where Allie and I talk about our favorite movies. And I post reviews of every movie I watch, just little blurbs. So if that sounds of any interest to you or you just want to help us out, maybe consider heading over there.
Big ups. Just kidding. I'm not going to do that again. Shout out to Abby Austin, who made our super beautiful cover art, and to Billy Libby, who did the beautiful bisexual soundtrack theme music to our podcast. Both of their social media handles are in, what's it called, that?
The episode description?
The episode description.
Professional podcast producer, Allison Rogers.
Yeah, listen. listen, the shit's going down. I'm soon to be a professional person.
Our social media handles are also in the description. And of course, Snails and Oysters is at Snails Oysters on Twitter. Feel free to shoot us a message if you like the show and just want to tell us, or you have an idea for a bi movie that we may not already have on the list. Or if you disagree with one of our Mary Fuck Kill takes, obviously not relevant this week, but it usually is.
But 1 week it might be relevant to
you. 1 week. It's been 1 week. Anyway, before I start singing the entirety of that classic Bare Naked Ladies track, I'm Nat Roberts.
And I'm Allie Rogers.
And thank you for being
a bi ally.
Comrade.